Today on the 21st Show, we're broadcasting live from the Illinois State House, leading into special coverage of Governor J.B. Pritzker's State of the State address, which begins 1 hour from now. We begin by talking about the Democratic supermajority's agenda with Speaker of the Illinois House, Emanuel Chris Welch. We'll also talk with his newly elected Republican counterpart, House Minority Leader Tony McCombie. And finally, because the governor will also be laying out his budget proposal for the next year, we'll talk with a panel of Illinois experts about how the state has been doing and what to expect in the months and years ahead. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WVIK in the Quad Cities. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are broadcasting live this morning from the Illinois State House, where Governor J.B. Pritzker is set to deliver his State of the State address at noon today. We'll be bringing you live coverage and analysis of that for the next 2 hours, and we begin with one of the key members of the audience for the governor's speech, the Speaker of the Illinois House of Representatives, Emanuel Chris Welch. He's been in the role for a little more than 2 years, and he joins me now live in person in the State House. Speaker Welch, welcome back to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
What are you hoping to hear from Governor Pritzker today?
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing from the governor, number one, because it's the first time I get to present him on the floor of the House chamber since I've been speaker. So just having him in the House, I'm really excited about.
That's right, because COVID know, 2 years ago and
my,
then
my first snowstorm, year was completely virtual. Last year was the snowstorm where he ended up at the old state capitol, but we still watched it on a live stream, so virtual. This year, it's great to be back. It's great to be in person. It's just another step toward normalcy after a long pandemic here. And so I'm excited about that to begin with. I'm certainly looking forward to all he has to say because we have really done some great things and moved Illinois forward. Organizations outside of here are acknowledging the work that we've done to improve the state. And the governor's going to talk about why we're strong, why the state is strong. And so I'm looking forward to hearing him lay it all out.
Yeah, you mentioned the pandemic is receding, but of course you're going to be alone up there because Senate President Harmon has tested positive for that. A little departure from the usual view that people have of this speech. But I want to ask you about some of the things that we're expecting the governor to talk about. He's talked a lot about enacting universal preschool, free higher education for people in the working class. I think that's what he said in his inaugural address. What is the receptivity of that among House Democrats? Where is the money going to come from for that?
Well, let me tell you, the work that we have done the last few years has really put us in a good position today where we can at least talk about these things. Let's remember what's happening here today. Today's the State of the State and the budget address. It's the beginning of the budget making process. So negotiations will begin after today. And so the governor's talking about some things that he knows are important to this state, important to the development of a child. And we're in a position now where we can legitimately have those conversations, and we should be proud of that. And now we can have that policy discussion knowing that we have the ability to pay for it. The money is there. We've had balanced budgets the last 4 years. You're going to see the governor present a balanced budget proposal today that we'll have a surplus at the end of it. If this isn't the time to talk about important policy changes like that, I don't know what is.
The state has benefited from a lot of federal support in the past few years because of the pandemic, as many states have. Illinois is not unique in that regard, but $8 billion, I think, was the amount, give or take. Is Illinois ready to make to go forward without that sort of support in the future?
Well,
will we still have balanced budgets?
Let's be clear. We've balanced our budgets without the federal government money. We've balanced our budgets because of hard work, rolling up our sleeves and making the tough decisions. What we did, I think, smartly was use the federal dollars to pay down, one-time things. We didn't use that money to create new base expectations. That's where
new
we
programs,
would
programs. That's right.
Correct. We would have run into trouble if we had done something like that. What we were able to do, and the governor is going to talk about that in his speech today, is talk about over the last year and a half, we've paid off $10.5 billion in debt. That's what we did with the federal money. That's what the smart thing to do was. But we've also had great revenue generation over that same time because of things we put in place, and that revenue generation continues. So we're able to have some conversations today that, you know, 4 years ago we weren't able to have.
Do you think Illinois could, with there's, you know, who can say what the economy is going to do, right? But there are sayers out there who are predicting a recession. Is Illinois in a better position today than, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years ago to withstand that kind of thing? Because the Great Recession, you know, as well as going even back to the dot-com bust of 20 years ago, really hurt the state's finances and led to some of the big problems we're still digging out of today.
Well, the short answer to that question is yes. The longer answer is yes, because revenue generation is good. We've done some things that have helped create better revenue in this state. That goes back to some things we did right at the beginning of the Pritzker administration. That's very important. We've paid off debts. I think that's extremely important. We've had 6 credit upgrades. It's cheaper for the state to borrow money. And this budget, which is balanced and has a surplus, if passed as presented, additional monies would go into the rainy day fund, a fund that we've over $2 billion in. At the end of this budget, hopefully it'll be about $2.5 billion, which is about 5% of this budget. Credit agencies recommend 5% of your budget should be in a rainy day fund. That would lead to more credit upgrades. 5, 10, 20, 15 years ago, we didn't have a rainy day fund. So we have better revenue generation. We have a rainy day fund because we've been saving for that rainy day here in Illinois. When was the last time you were able to say Illinois and rainy day fund in the same sentence? We're proud of that work, and it's led to some important credit upgrades, which just last week the Civic Committee acknowledged that our budget is in fiscal condition is the best in decades because of the hard work that we've done.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with the Speaker of the Illinois House of Representatives, Chris Welch. I want to ask you, Democrats have, listeners should know, Democrats have significant super majorities in the Illinois House, almost 2-1 in terms of Democrats versus Republicans. But the Republicans do represent a significant portion of Illinois, and they are asking this year for greater involvement in the budget process, more time to review proposals before voting and so on. I'm guessing that sounds like a pretty reasonable ask to a lot of people who might be listening to us. What do you say to them on that?
Listen, Illinois is in much better position fiscally for than it's been in decades. And we've largely gotten there because of Democrats. I say that because Republicans have just traditionally not voted for the budget. I said it in January. I said it 2 years ago. And I'll say it again. I'm willing to work with anyone who's willing to work with me in good faith. Anyone who has a common cause and want to work in good faith, I'm willing to work with them, and I think that's very important. But they have to come to the table willing to work. You know, what they've done the last few years is come to the table to be obstructionists and just to vote no. You know, we want them to participate. That's good for democracy. When I took that oath of office on January 11th, I took an oath of office as Speaker of the House, not Speaker of the Democrats. And so it's important that I serve as Speaker of the House. Republicans are welcome to be a part of this process, but they have to be active participants and be willing to vote for a budget. We've come a long way. No one's going to get 100% of what they want. No one. And I'm hoping that, you know, they will come, they will participate, and they will vote for a budget and be a part of the success story that we're telling.
Because, I should tell our listeners, because we're broadcasting live on location today, we're not taking calls as we often do, but you can always let us know what you think by emailing talk@21stshow.org. And we also asked listeners in our texting group this morning what they thought of the state of the state and their representation in Springfield. One listener, Sarah in Rockford, said she doesn't think that Democrats represent the full state of Illinois. I'm going to read from her text here. I live 90 minutes west of Chicago in a rural area. Big city politics is killing the agriculture industry, forcing small farmers to give up or sell out. Instead of fixing our food system, they make it harder and harder to get licensure and do business. I feel like they just don't care. End quote. What do you have to say to listeners like Sarah?
Well, Sarah, let me say this. I hear you. I disagree with you on this particular topic. Our caucus is 78 members strong. It's the largest in modern history since the Cutback Amendment in 1980. But amongst that 78 Democrats, there's 11 sub-caucuses. It's racially, ethically, gender, geographically balanced. We have Democrats all over this state. We have progressives. We have moderates. We have conservatives within our own caucus. And we have some very good debates amongst ourselves because I tell our caucus all the time, diversity is the strength of our state. It's certainly the strength of our caucus, but we only get things done when we do it with unity. So there's a lot of things we do to build consensus on issues. We get a lot of things done that way. No one gets 100% of what they want, but I can tell you we've been very successful the last couple of years because of that consensus building model. And you have to listen to every part of this state, every group that's represented in this state, and that includes rural areas. I got to tell you, one of the things I'm also proud of is I'm very involved with Whiteside County Farm Bureau. I've been their adopted legislator for the last 10 years. They were at my inauguration on January 11th as speaker. They had never attended an inauguration ceremony before. That's the type of relationship we've developed. I have visited Whiteside County every year for 10 years. And I've learned so much about farming that I never knew before. And I think it's important that we are accessible and open to everyone to hear what their issues are. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of progress. Is there more to do? Absolutely. We can always do more. But we've come a long way. And so to say that Democrats don't hear them, clearly that's not showing up at the ballot box. You know, the largest caucus in modern history, someone is seeing the work that we're doing.
I also want to ask you about some of the policy issues that Democrats had focused on in the recent past. So far, a relatively small number of judges in central and southern Illinois have been throwing wrenches into, you can go back to the state's COVID response, the attempt to end cash bond, the ban on the future sale and possession of assault weapons. What should the legislature do in response to these challenges to the laws it's enacting on behalf of the people?
Well, let me say this. First of all, I can't really comment on the substance of litigation, particularly ongoing litigation. But these lawsuits that have been filed are clearly being filed in courts that the plaintiffs prefer. They're going to continue to do that. And we have to allow the system and the process to play out. We are the legislature. We're the legislative body. We have a constitutional charge. We've accepted that charge, and we've done it in a constitutional manner. We believe that when this thing plays out in the full justice system, if it goes to the Supreme Court, we believe that we will prevail as we have prevailed on other matters that have been brought by these same plaintiffs in their preferred courts.
If the courts ultimately do, not talking about the litigation itself, but if the courts do strike down the bond, the Safety Act with the bond and elimination of cash bond or the assault weapons ban, is the legislature prepared to revisit those issues, to start over? Where do you go from there?
Brian, there's a lot of work that went into the Safety Act, a lot of work that went into the assault weapons ban. The advice and counsel that has been given on both of those was taken into consideration. And we are confident we're going to prevail when this thing plays out through the court system. You asked me a what-if question. I don't even think we have to get into it because I'm pretty confident we're going to be successful. But, you know, if a court were to strike down a law, a legislature's obligation would be to go back and address it. And if that day ever came, we would certainly do our part and go back and see what we can do different.
Just a couple of minutes left in our time together. You've been speaker for a little more than 2 years now. What has that experience taught you about the exercise of power that maybe you didn't appreciate before?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of Hamilton. If you've never seen Hamilton,
the man, or the musical?
Both.
Okay.
Hamilton, the man and the musical. I know the history. I'm a student of American history. And if you've never seen the musical, you should go see it, because there's a lot of lessons in that musical, particularly leadership lessons. And one of the things that comes to mind for me is, you know, who's going to tell our story? History has its eyes on us. And so I'm mindful of that every day. I think it's important that we be conscious of the fact that history has its eyes on us. And I'm not going to always be Speaker of the House. When I'm done, what's the story that's going to be told? What's the history that we will have made? And I want to make sure that's a positive story, that we've left a positive mark, that we helped this great state and moved it forward. History has its eyes on us, and that's important to me.
Yeah. You're in the room where it happened, just about a minute remaining. You talked about the diversity of your caucus. Has that been a challenge, sort of getting everybody on the same page, progressives downstate, upstate?
You know, diversity, you know, when you have diversity of thought, that's going to bring its own inherent challenges. But I think as a leader, it's my job to make sure that we have the mechanisms in place to embrace that diversity of thought. We use working groups quite a bit. That's something that, if you're a student of history, you know George Washington did even before he was president. When he was commander of our armed forces during the American Revolution, he called them fly camps. He often met in small groups with soldiers and got their opinions on how he should lead. Those fly camps were very important to him, similar to working groups for me. And that's how we get that consensus amongst us and move things forward. And so I think it's important that we continue to be inclusive and collaborative. It may take a little longer, but we get it done with consensus.
All right. Well, we will be continuing to keep our eyes on you in the months ahead. Speaker Chris Welch, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you, my friend. It was a pleasure.
Emmanuel Chris Welch is a Democrat from Hillside. He's also, as I said, Speaker of the Illinois House. More to come on the 21st Show after a short break. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, live in the Illinois State House. We are about 36 minutes away from Governor J.B. Pritzker delivering his combined State of the State and budget address. It's been 3 years since the governor delivered a speech like this to a joint session of the General Assembly. 2 years ago, owing to pandemic safety considerations, he broadcast the speech from an expo building on the Illinois State Fairgrounds. Then last year, when a winter storm was expected to dump a substantial amount of snow on Springfield, the House and Senate canceled their in-person session, so he again went remote, speaking from the old state Capitol building. Now he will be back with lawmakers face-to-face in the Illinois House chambers, two floors above where I'm broadcasting from in the Capitol building. Joining us remotely now and throughout our broadcast today are two experts on Illinois government and its finances. Amanda Cass is assistant professor in the School of Public Service at DePaul University in Chicago. Amanda, always good to talk with you about state money matters. Thanks for being with us again today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And David Merriman is the James J. Stuckel Presidential Professor in the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He's also co-lead of the Fiscal and Economic Policy Working Group at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, which is a think tank spanning all three campuses of the University of Illinois. David, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And listeners, as I've mentioned earlier, because we're broadcasting on location, we're not taking calls today, but you can always let us know what you thought in real time by emailing talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org, or message us on Twitter @21stshow. So, Amanda, I want to begin with you. To the extent people follow state government finance news, they're probably used to hearing a lot of negative talk about the state. We heard some pretty positive talk from the speaker a few minutes ago. How would you say Illinois is doing today?
That's a great question. I think Illinois is certainly doing a lot better than it was 5 or 6 years ago. So if we think back 5 or 6 years ago, remember we were in a real budget crisis. The income tax rates had decreased. There was a budget impasse and the state was building up a massive backlog of bills. So we're certainly better than we were in, say, 2017. But I would say, you know, really righting the state's finances is like turning a carrier ship. And so while I think we're turning and moving in a positive direction, I would say I think we still have a kind of ways to go to really have a robustly improved financial picture.
David, what's your perspective on that?
Well, it's somewhat similar. I guess one thing I should say is that I've been writing reports about the fiscal condition of the state for 15 years, sort of annually, and the report that we're just about to publish is the best report we've ever written in terms of the fiscal condition of the state. I think, you know, that the Speaker Welch I heard earlier on your show said, well, we've made the hard choices. We've gotten here by making the hard choices. I think we have to say, you know, what specific hard choices have we made? We've had a lot of good fortune to get where we are, and in a certain way, we haven't messed it up. But I think you were asking the right questions when you ask about what happens if there's a recession. You know, what happens going forward?
You know, David, last year you co-authored a report looking at the massive deficit in Illinois' Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, noting that we were in a worse position than all but a handful of other states. Then in November, Governor Pritzker announced he had reached a deal to pay off that deficit. Can you talk about, you know, what that specific incident and or episode, however you want to refer to it, and what that says more broadly about state finances?
Well, of course, you know, the COVID shutdown was a massive blow to unemployment insurance systems around the country. Right, we had a ton of people that became suddenly unemployed, and we also had liberal rules about letting them collect, and so there was a big drain. And that, and naturally, it's not surprising that there was a big drain on the system and pushed us into deficit, but that's got to be true in every other state in the country, right? Illinois was not particularly unusual. Illinois had a little bit, you know, stricter rules that kept people out of work a little bit longer than some other states. But even if you look at other states that were sort of, you know, very cautious on COVID, Illinois' system deficit was very large. We've now solved, to some extent, we've dug out from that deficit. But have we solved the long-term problem of funding the unemployment insurance system in a way that is stable over the business cycle? The way Illinois has typically acted is during good times when unemployment rates are low, as it is today, we tended to, if anything, cut unemployment taxes, to cut premiums. And so we haven't built up the kind of surplus that we might need to carry us through in a severe recession.
Sure. All right, David Merriman and Amanda Cass, I'm going to ask you to hold on the line, and I'm going to come back to you in a little bit because I am joined now in person by the new Republican leader of the Illinois House of Representatives, Tony McCombie. Leader McCombie was born, raised, and resides in Savannah, Illinois, a small town on the Mississippi River in the northwest part of the state. She was previously mayor of the town and also worked in real estate there. She's been in the General Assembly since 2017, was selected by her peers to succeed former Republican leader Jim Durkin, who stepped down after his party lost a net of 5 seats in last year's elections. Leader McCombie, welcome back to the 21st show and for the first time in your new role.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
What are you hoping to hear from Governor Pritzker today?
Well, I'm hoping that the temperature is not real hot first. I think the delivery could set the tone for the rest of the GA. So I'm hoping that it's respectful and we can disagree on maybe what's going to come out on the policies and the programs and how we pay for them. But I hope the delivery is kind.
Kind. Do you get the sense that the governor is not usually well, be more fiery than other times?
You know, we do live in the world of politics, yeah, sure. Right? Yeah. So you have to fire up your base once in a while. I just don't think that today's the day. We have been having conversation and meeting, and yesterday we sat down briefly, myself, the other three leaders and him, and it seemed all very kumbaya.
Yeah.
So I just hope that continues today.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good time to ask because, I mean, the hard reality is that Democrats do hold a 78-40 seat advantage in the House. If most of their members stick together, they don't need Republican votes. How do you work to make sure your party remains relevant to lawmaking in general and the budget process in particular in Illinois?
Well, I've been saying this quite a bit. Although we do have 40 members, we do represent parts of all 102 counties. So to have our voices ignored because they can would be completely inappropriate. So many know me, and I'm certainly not going to stop knocking on the door. I'm not going to end conversations. And I'll just keep fighting to get us there. We just yesterday announced five working groups to address some of our priorities, and it would be my honor to have that legislation passed and be good for the entire state. So that's one of the things I said to the governor yesterday. I said, you know, use us. We have a lot of talent. We have, like I said, 40 members, but we have folks that are in business, criminal justice, serving our most vulnerable, financing, and, you know, use our talents to get good things done for Illinois.
When I was speaking with Speaker Welch on the program just a few minutes ago, he talked about the diversity of the Democratic caucus in terms of people from Chicago and downstate and progressives and moderates. You yourself have different factions within the Republican House group. How do you navigate those differences between the more maybe traditional business Chamber of Commerce type Republicans and the more, you know, Freedom Caucus, the people who are a little more pugnacious, to put it mildly?
Yeah, you know, we also have the geographic diversity in the Republican Party, and that it is how partially I chose some of the leaders on my leadership team so that we would have a voice, you know, across and around the state, and including Cook County with our leader Brad Stevens. So, and Jackie Haas has, you know, a little bit there, but we are all still Republicans. We still have, you know, shared values. It's how we interact with one another with respect, and we're doing that. So I think that's important. We can all have difference of opinions within our party. Democrats do it better than we do. They are unified. They fight behind closed doors. Republicans go at it out in the public, right? I wish we didn't do that as much, We're more unified when we come out, and we're working on that. And I don't think anyone has seen that with this new GA. We are talking and conversing, and we're agreeing on most things. So, but I even think in the Republican Party, it's not good to always agree on all things, because then where's that conversation? And how do we learn?
Yeah. Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Tony McCombie, the Republican leader of the Illinois House of Representatives, newly elected to that position for this session, succeeding former Republican leader Jim Durkin. I wanted to ask you about a couple of things we're expecting to hear from the governor today. He's talked a lot about universal preschool and free higher education for people in the working class, as he said in his inaugural address. Acknowledging that the devil will be in the details and we need to hear more about that. Are Republicans prepared to support those ideas, at least conceptually?
Well, we're certainly not against those ideas, but to say it's going to be free college is going to be false if that's how they're going to bring it forward. $100 million more for MAP grants is the story, right? So not everybody's going to qualify for that additional MAP grant dollars. So to say it's free.
It's not like you can just walk into a community college, yeah, and sit down with no paperwork.
Right. And I remember years ago sitting down with a representative. I've got a community college in my district, Sauk Valley Community College, and they've started an earned tuition program. And you sign up in, I believe it's eighth grade, and you every year do community service for your for the college, and you just build up, which builds community, right? And they earn their way into the community college. And I think that is a much better way to go about it, because you and I both know nothing's free. Somebody's going to pay for it somewhere around. And $100 million to the MAP grant, that's not free money. We have to pay for that. We are talking about, certainly in one of our working groups, the cost of education, education itself, family and children issues. And one of those is accessibility, especially in our rural areas, to daycare, to preschool. And one of the questions I had for the governor when we sat down yesterday was, he was giving a scenario of a place that he visited, and they have a high number of kids waiting to get in there. And I said, okay, is that because the school doesn't have, you know, the daycare center doesn't have the capacity, or is it because maybe they don't have the people to work there? And so that's an issue, right? And we continue to pass mandates in Illinois that kind of make it difficult, even for home daycares. The regulations get to be too much. So the devil will be in the details. We want affordable college. We want access to preschool and daycare, and it does start with our children. We agree with that. It's how we get there is always the question.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned meeting with the governor and the legislative leaders yesterday. Unless I'm mistaken, you're the first woman in one of the two top leadership positions in the Illinois House, of course, from either party. We had former Senator Christine Redonio, who was the Senate Republican leader. Do you see significance in that? How do you think about that?
Well, I think it's great. I think it's long overdue, for sure. Women, I believe, are a little more persistent. I think the men in this table would probably agree. So I think that's a good thing, and I think that's what they need. I'm also not afraid to let myself be vulnerable. And I think that's important when you're negotiating and talking about legislation that affects people. And sometimes I think men have a hard time doing that. So, you know, I'm willing to put it all out there.
You're also one of the only other legislative leaders from downstate, which I realize is kind of ridiculous given how far north in Illinois Savannah is. But it's
right.
People mean that. Today, I mean not the Chicago metropolitan area. And really only one of two leaders from downstate in the past decade. Do you see that as a void in representation among the leadership of this state?
You know, I don't think so. I think it's just, it's a talking point, right? The thing about being a legislator, whether you are in Cook County or the suburbs or Southern Illinois or where I am in Northwest Illinois, it's about us getting around and learning parts of the state. And I've been doing that since I was elected. Because I can serve my own district the more I know, and the state. Because even though I'm just voting for the 89th district, we are making policy for the entire state. So it's important for us to get around, and I think the Republican caucus does that very well. We visit each other and Dem districts as well to learn more. So I just think it's just a talking point.
We only have a couple of minutes left in our conversation. You and I have not spoken on our program in a few years. I think it was the early months of the pandemic. You were bringing forward some ideas about reopening the state at that time. But there is a question I've been asking to every Republican office holder and candidate in the past few years, and that's about the 2020 presidential election. Who won it? Was it a free and fair election? I have a broader point on this.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not sure if you're aware, but Biden won.
Well,
and when it comes to a fair election, here's the thing. Governors, there are some governors, and I've asked Republicans and others around the state, if governors are in some states, I believe it's six or seven, don't quote me on that exactly, changed election laws by executive order. That was inappropriate. So if that's the talking point that folks want to say, and maybe those states, but our governor has the majority, and he came before the House and the Senate and requested changes to the election law, and to my dismay, did it properly. So
The reason I ask that, obviously Biden won. I know that. You know that. And
I know not everybody. That's why I love this media stuff,
well,
right?
But not everybody in your party thinks that way. And I guess, do you see, and unfortunately we only have about 30 seconds left, but is the path back to more power in Illinois for Republicans dealing with questions like that, things that are a turnoff for a lot of voters here?
Yeah, I think those kind of questions are silly. I mean, no offense to you personally. I mean, I know you have to do your job, right? That, right? I just think it's a moot point. You know, I'm looking forward to a robust Republican primary. I'm looking to see some change and, you know, removing Biden from office the proper way. At the polls.
All right. Leader Toni McCombie is the House Minority Leader, the Republican leader in the Illinois House. She's a Republican from Savannah, Illinois. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks
on the
for
show.
Having us.
I appreciate it. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, live in the Illinois State House. We are just over 15 minutes away from Governor J.B. Pritzker delivering his annual State of the State address, and combined this year with his budget message. To talk about what to expect, I'm again joined remotely by Amanda Cass, assistant professor in the School of Public Service at DePaul University in Chicago, and David Merriman, professor in the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's also co-lead of the Fiscal and Economic Policy Working Group at the U of I's Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Because we are broadcasting on location, we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you think in real time by emailing talk at 21stshow.org or message us on Twitter at 21st Show. So, Amanda, I wonder what you think about, you know, one thing, one of the themes I think we've been talking about today is the Democratic supermajority. They have a nearly 2-to-1 advantage in the House. If they stick together, they don't need Republican votes. How have you seen that affecting budget making in Illinois, big picture?
Sure. So I think, you know, big picture, we've seen some significant changes. So one of the big changes that impacted state revenue was increasing the income tax rates. But there are some limitations to what the legislature can do on its own. And I think when we're talking about the state's fiscal system, one of the biggest ones is changing the structure of the income tax rate in Illinois. So our state constitution mandates that we have a flat rate. A couple of years ago, right, the General Assembly passed a proposed constitutional amendment asking voters, do we want to change the state's income tax structure from a flat rate to a graduated, and voters rejected it. So I think that highlights to me a really important limitation of what, even with a supermajority, the General Assembly can do.
David, what's your perspective on that? I'm thinking now of a paper you wrote a year or two ago that was like, of course, Illinois doesn't have a flat tax, and neither does any other state. But big picture, what you see is
right.
The supermajority's, you know, effect on our state's finances and government overall.
Going back to the budgeting question, I mean, I think Illinois has been. It's not only did the Democrats not share that much with the Republicans, but it's also been very leadership driven, at least under Speaker Madigan, in terms of the budgeting policy. So even the rank and file, I think, you know, weren't fully engaged. And a lot often the budget is passed. You know, it's not I think the Republicans do have a point that there's not sufficient time to think about it and to really analyze it before it has to be passed. I think journalists also have difficulty with that. It's often we don't get a lot of the details until very late in the process. So I think the fact that the Democrats have such strong majorities has, you know, really truncated the discussion and made the budgeting decisions less transparent.
Yeah, no, and I mean, from my own personal standpoint, as a reporter who's been covering state government off and on since 2005, it used to be we would have a briefing the night before this sort of speech, and we'd get the full set of materials, a big thick packet of information, or a CD-ROM back in the day, ask your parents, and, you know, we would have time to go through it and digest it and talk to people about it. And now this morning there was a briefing for reporters. Am I allowed to even mention it? There was a PowerPoint slide, and that's it. So, there's definitely more about message than substance, it seems, these days, at least in the public communication about the budget. Amanda, I want to come back to something that I brought up with the speaker earlier, and I know you've done work on this question of what Illinois did with $8.1 billion, from the federal government during the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you talk about how that money was spent and what the consequences of, you know, not having that sort of cash just flowing into the state's coffers will be in the short-term future?
Sure. So the state of Illinois got that money from the American Rescue Plan Act, and that $8.1 billion, the state has until the end of calendar year 2026 to spend the money. So while the state's adopted plans for how to use all of that money, we still have a couple more years for it to be spent. A good chunk of it, so of that $8.1 billion, $2.7 billion, so was used just for addressing the deficit in the unemployment trust fund. And then another about $1 billion of that was spent on infrastructure capital programs, so one-time type spending. And then I think the rest of it, it's a little murky still to figure out what the remaining amount went to recurring expenses versus one-time expenses, which is a long way of saying it's still a little unclear to me if we've created any sort of fiscal cliff with that $8.1 billion.
Yeah. Because if it was used for recurring expenses, then we're going to need to find that money from somewhere else, is the short answer there.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the challenges in trying to kind of figure that out is governments are allowed to use their ARPA money, their American Rescue Plan Act money, as revenue replacement. So to make up for revenue that was lost due to COVID. And so they can then use that money and put it into the general fund, kind of commingle it with other revenue sources and use it for general operations. So that makes it really hard to tease out and figure out at a line item level what that ARPA money actually went to. So again, creates a challenge for figuring it out of if we've created any fiscal cliff. And kind of adding to the challenge of that is we've seen revenue performance. So we had the influx of one-time money from the federal government, but we've also seen the state's own source revenue overperform expectations. So income tax revenue has come in higher than expected. Sales tax revenue has come in higher than expected. And it's, I think, a little unclear about that too, if that's our kind of new normal, or if we're seeing effects from the various federal COVID stimulus playing out in our revenue collection.
Or inflation, perhaps, with the sales tax collection.
Yeah, of course, inflation.
Yeah, yeah. We're all paying more for bacon and eggs, and the state is reaping the benefits. And who can begrudge them that? I also want to ask about pensions. And we've got, I should mention to listeners, this is the 21st show. We are segueing into live special coverage of Governor Pritzker's State of the State address, which is scheduled to begin about 10 minutes from now. We're talking about what to expect in the state of Illinois' finances with Amanda Cass from DePaul University and David Merriman with the University of Illinois Chicago and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois System. David, Illinois' pension contribution in the current fiscal year was $9.9 billion, I believe. That's hard to wrap your mind around. That's a little more than the state spent on K-12 education. Can you talk about people talk about a crowding out effect of pension contributions. Pensions were much discussed a few years ago. You don't hear as much about them from politicians anymore. Talk about what effect that has, you know, what in the constellation of the Illinois state finances.
Yeah, I mean, pensions are obviously a very, very large expenditure. You know, I think that, you know, the very important structural change that was made in 2010 was that starting in, you know, then we established a tier two pension system. And now we've had, you know, more than 10 years of hiring people under that. So the pension problem, to me, it's a legacy debt We're in the process of solving it. We know we can plan for those very large expenditures. I don't think, you know, I guess I'm more of a optimist about this than some other people. I don't think it's really needs to hamstring the state, especially as Amanda mentioned, with, you know, revenues really surging now. I think it's a it's something that we have to plan for, but that we can handle it. You know, there is a volatility in the equities market, and a lot of the pension fund is, of course, invested there, but I think we'll probably ride that out. So my view is, at this point, it's a manageable constraint on the budget.
Amanda Kess, what's your perspective on that in terms of the pensions and crowding out other spending? Manageable, or is this something where people should be a little more concerned? Because there are still voices out there that sort of portray this as kind of a raging inferno that everyone is just ignoring.
I largely agree with David. And if David and I co-authored a piece, gosh, several years ago now, actually trying to bring some more nuance to discussion about pensions. Because when we're talking about the pension systems and if there is a quote unquote pension crisis or pension problem, one thing we kind of argued was we really need to make some distinctions between the budgetary challenge that's created about how much the state has to contribute into the pension systems each year. And so I agree with David that I don't think that's kind of a crisis and we can kind of hold steady with that. And then the other kind of aspect to it is about the funding level for the pension systems themselves, because a real crisis scenario happens if the pension systems ever ran out of money and were unable to continuing making benefit payments out to retirees. And we're not in that situation. The pension systems funding levels have essentially been kind of just treading water since the last financial crisis, the 2008 financial crisis. And so I think it's really important when we're talking about pensions to kind of really be careful and distinguish, like, what are we actually talking about? And the good news is, at least if the state sticks to the funding plan that's in law, we should start seeing the pension system's funding levels increase in the future.
Yeah, and of course, I don't hear anyone proposing seriously the sort of pension holidays, which was the euphemism used a few decades ago, I think in the Blagojevich administration. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but to not make the pension payments for a year in order to shore up general revenue. David, do you get the sense that state lawmakers are on the right track with this and that they're, you know, behaving more responsibly about it than they and their forebears did in the past?
Well, I do, but you know, this is a relatively easy time, right? Where the state is flush with revenues, both because of federal revenues and because we've had a surge in own source revenues, the taxes that Amanda talked about earlier. So, yeah, we're going to make the payments now. We're probably going to make more than the payments, right? The required payments right now. The real question is, will we stick to that when times are not so good? And at this point, I think hopefully there's been enough attention and enough focus and people have learned enough lessons that we realize we have to continue making these payments. But it's very enticing when, you know, there's many more competing demands for your money that are immediate than you have money available for to, you know, not make your investments in the pension fund.
Amanda, we're about 4 minutes away from when we're expecting the governor to give his speech. What are you going to be listening for today from Governor Pritzker?
I think I'm going to be listening to see what the governor has to say in terms of revenue projections. So what are they looking forward? What is the state predicting for recurring revenue? And then the kind of increased spending, as you were talking about, into education, especially early education. And I'm curious to see, like, how much is the governor proposing to invest in increased early education, early childhood education?
Yeah. David, same question to you. What are you going to be listening for?
Yeah, I think, you know, Amanda's right. Something that Amanda mentioned earlier about, you know, what is continuing spending and what is one-time spending out of the federal money. I think what I'd like to hear from the governor is some stern talk about the fact that, we've got to bring structural stability to the budget and that federal money is not going to be used to support expanding programs that we cannot, that we can't fund through our own sources.
You know what, that expression I'm reminded of sometimes, it's better to be lucky than good. Do you think overall, and maybe both of you in turn, has Illinois been lucky or good? Or, what share of each would you rate? 50-50 or some other ratio? And Amanda, I'll start with you.
I think so. In this, I just want to say, one voice we're really missing today is Lawrence Massal, because I feel like to that question of, has the state been lucky or good? I can just picture Lawrence Massal having a very quippy response to it. Yeah. I think the state has been both lucky and good. I think that they've been very prudent of using a lot of the money towards one-time, a lot of the ARPA money towards one-time expenses. There's been a lot of focus on paying down bills and also trying to build up the budget stabilization fund.
Yeah, and Lawrence Massal, of course, was the Civic Federation head who has been on this program just a month ago for the inaugural speech. He died, sadly, at the age of 61, was a strong voice for fiscal stability and transparency in government. David Merriman, about a minute, and then we need to take a brief break to let stations join and leave our broadcast. Has Illinois been lucky or good?
Well, I also want to say how much we miss Lawrence. And I would just say, some of both. One thing that has, I'm an economist by training and has us scratching our head a little bit is where's all the revenue coming? We've got this surge of revenue, which just is a stroke of immense good luck. Illinois hasn't blown it. So I have to say, in my history of covering Illinois, this is not always the case. So I'm very, very happy that Illinois has not blown it. So.
All right. Well, we are going to continue broadcasting here. This has been the 21st show. We are now sort of transitioning over to live special coverage. We're expecting the governor to begin his remarks any moment now at the Illinois State House. He's going to be addressing a joint session of the General Assembly for the first time in several years. Last year, there was a snowstorm. The year before that, there was the pandemic. So now he is back face to face. From Illinois Public Media, you're listening to live coverage of the governor's State of the State and budget address.